Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Thursday the 25th of June. Today, the government is forced to defend its borrowing policy from criticism from the Governor of the Bank of England.
This is potentially pretty explosive stuff. There's a convention that the Bank of England doesn't talk directly about fiscal policy, just as the Treasury is now not really meant to pontificate on the subject of where interest rates should be.
Also today, a major operation by UK troops in southern Afghanistan.
Not only was the scale of the operation extremely impressive, so too was the operation extremely important.
And we look at the ongoing hunt for Osama bin Laden.
He is supposed to suffer from long-term kidney disease, but rumours of his death have been much exaggerated over the months and years.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton's got the news and the papers.
More than 70 people have been killed in a bomb explosion in Baghdad, which went off in an open market in the Shia area of Sadr City. People were doing their evening shopping at the time. It's believed it had been hidden under a pile of vegetables on a cart or rickshaw, and comes only a week before US soldiers are due to pull out of Iraqi cities. There were more bloody clashes in Tehran yesterday between protesters against the election result and security forces. Witnesses said a square near the parliament was like a war zone, with several thousand riot police and security forces facing demonstrators in their hundreds. Many were reported severely beaten. Supporters of presidential candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi, who are still contesting the election results, say they'll try a new form of protest on Friday. They'll release balloons mourning a student who was shot by security forces this week. Here in Britain, the Parliamentary Public Accounts Committee says the Treasury was caught flat-footed by the collapse of Northern Rock 2 years ago. The MPs say civil servants weren't prepared for the failure and didn't react very fast. Energy customers are being overcharged by £1.5 billion a year, according to the watchdog Consumer Focus. It claims energy companies haven't passed on the fall in wholesale prices of gas and electricity. Energy bills rose by 42% last year, and the watchdog says each household is overcharged by £74 a year. But the companies claim half their costs are transporting supplies around the country, which have risen sharply. There's not much agreement on front page leads in the morning papers. The Guardian reports the Conservatives are already preparing for taking over government after the next election, fearing they may need to cut public spending by as much as 10%. The paper says Shadow Chancellor George Osborne's planning a special two-day cabinet meeting to bind ministers into the cuts. In contrast, the paper also reports there's a new buzzword in the City of London, BAB. That's bonuses are back. The Telegraph and the Financial Times focus on the Governor of the Bank of England's warning to the Treasury. Cuts and tax rises, there is no other way, the Telegraph headline, because of what Mervyn King told MPs was the extraordinary scale of government borrowing. The FT says there's another argument over controlling the financial markets. It talks of the lack of trust between the bank and the government, as the Governor claims he's not been adequately consulted over regulatory reform. Finally, the Mail shares its front page. There's a glamour picture of the tennis player who beat Maria Sharapova at Wimbledon yesterday, Gisela Dulko. Its other headline reads, Mr. and Mrs. Expenses, House Under Threat. The story focuses on married Labour MPs. Anne and Alan Keane face having their so-called main home in Hounslow, West London, seized by the council because it has been empty for months. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
The Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, has said the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, must cut government debt more quickly as the economy recovers. Taking questions from MPs yesterday at the Treasury Select Committee, King's comments undermined efforts by Gordon Brown to portray the Conservatives as the party of spending cuts. The Observer's business editor is Heather Stewart. She says King, in effect, attacked the government's borrowing policy.
He certainly did. I think this is potentially pretty explosive stuff. There's a convention that the Bank of England doesn't talk directly about fiscal policy, just as the Treasury is now not really meant to pontificate on the subject of where interest rates should be. And yet King made a very direct intervention, and he said if the economy recovers as rapidly as the government expected it to in its budget forecasts, that the deficit should be cut back. In other words, that public spending should be cut faster than the Treasury envisages. And this is politically very explosive territory, because Gordon Brown is very keen to paint the next election as a battle between a Labour Party that would continue to hold levels of investment, public spending quite high, and a Tory party that would cut that back. And actually what Mervyn King is saying is, hang on, these deficits are so big, whatever party is in power after the next election, they're going to have to cut public spending hard.
And there was more bad news for the government yesterday. The OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development think tank, says that the UK's not only in a severe recession, but it's revising down its growth forecast, and says that, you know, while the rest of the world is seeing the end is in sight for the recession, the UK's not performing quite so well.
Indeed, this is pretty depressing news for the government, really. I mean, the OECD now thinks that the economy will contract by a pretty catastrophic 4.3% this year and then will be flat through 2010. So there's been a lot of talk of green shoots recently, and there is some evidence that the economy is turning up. But actually, there are a lot of unsolved problems, including the dire state of the banks, which are still refusing to lend to companies and so on. So there are lots of reasons to think that even if recovery is around the corner, it will be pretty slow and kind of long, painful process, I think. And that's the issue that the OECD is highlighting.
Meanwhile, Heather, the other pillar of the tripartite system, the Financial Services Authority, revealed yesterday in its annual report that 14% of its salary bill consisted of bonuses. The FSA, the city watchdog, awarded its former director a £400,000 payoff. Why has the FSA awarded these bonuses?
Well, I think it just demonstrates that the culture of performance-related bonuses is entrenched not just in the city, but in a much wider swathe of life, including in public life and public service. And arguably, you know, the FSA has watched the practices of the banks it supervised for many years, where this sort of structure is absolutely the norm and you know, accepts the idea that this is the way to incentivise people. But actually, I think if you're a member of the public, it's probably pretty surprising that this is something that's happening within the public sector.
They're clearly aware of this, though, because Hector Sants, the FSA boss, waived his bonus of £130,000.
Yes, I think that's very interesting. I think they probably realised that there'd be some pretty shocking headlines, given that it's hard to argue that the FSA has done its job properly during this downturn. It would be pretty extraordinary for anyone to be receiving a bonus this year, I think. So I think that's a sensible gesture on Hector Sants's part.
Heather Stewart, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, Steve Jobs' liver transplant will seriously limit his capacity to work. Charles Arthur and Bobby Johnson examine how Apple will fare without its talismanic leader. guardian.co.uk/technology. The Equality and Human Rights Commission has threatened the far-right British National Party with legal action over possible breaches of anti-discrimination law. Joseph Harker says that of all the equality issues to be taking a stand on, surely this must be the most ridiculous ever conceived. Have your say on that at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And Maria Sharapova was knocked out of Wimbledon yesterday, but she's the subject of Hannah Poole's Question Time today at guardian.co.uk/G2. Iran's supreme leader says the government won't yield to demonstrators who are demanding the disputed election result be annulled. Meanwhile, Zahra Rahnavard, the wife of the opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi, called for the release of protesters who'd been arrested over the last 2 weeks. She likened the current situation to martial law. Masoumeh Torfe is an academic specialising in Iran at the University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies. Our Middle East editor Ian Black asked her about the regime's recent accusations that the West was behind the protests.
It's part and parcel of their style, and I think it's a very good way of arresting people, even of justifying why they've killed them. Because if you say that these people are spies run by American and British intelligence and bring them on TV like they have been doing in the past few days, then you justify, in Islamic terms, why a Muslim is killing another Muslim.
But it's a completely cynical manoeuvre. It's designed to bolster the repressive powers of the state by accusing people falsely, we assume, of working for foreign interests.
But as you know, this has been happening all the way through the 30 years of Islamic Republic. Every time they want to condemn someone, they want to put someone in prison, that's exactly the excuse. Many people who come and go to Iran are often labelled. In Kayhan newspaper is full of them. Every single person who goes and they don't like, there is a little article about them in Kayhan newspaper the next day saying they're working for foreigners.
Where do you think this leaves the large questions, the large international geostrategic questions, particularly about the Iranian nuclear program, about American, Western concerns, Israel and so on? We saw President Obama speak out after some hesitation about what's going on in Iran. Do you think that all those hopes for some kind of dialogue with Iran now lie in ruins, or is it too early to say?
Well, the reaction was partly surprising because the West has been trying to make contact. And indeed, Obama has played his cards very well. I think everyone has passed the opinion that he has been quite wise. He's been quite sensible in the way he's treated the whole situation. So I can't really foresee that discussion will take place very soon now, because obviously Khamenei with his speech and then with these tit-for-tat exchanges of diplomats, expulsions of diplomats, I think that's now gone to the background. And they see it more convenient to attack foreigners so that they can control inside. Once they've done that, they may make other approaches. And also, don't forget, a very important part of negotiations with the West, although not very many people discuss it, is Rafsanjani and is Khatami. And these two are now very quiet, both of them. So I think that will be delayed for at least 6 months to a year.
Do you think that the regime feels now that the moment of danger has passed because of the way it's acted in the last few days? Or do you think it still feels very much under threat? There's been this tremendous global interest in what's been going on. We've seen the very dramatic television images. We've seen the picture of the girl who was shot dead in a demonstration. That's gone right round the world, a martyr, if you like. There's been the whole Twitter phenomenon. This has become a story in media terms that the whole world is looking at. How do you think the regime in Tehran, in its inner sanctum, is feeling now after a few days of this sort of exposure?
It's actually amazing that the reason why this regime is so frightened is precisely the footage that came out of the very first few days when we had John Simpson of the BBC going amongst the crowd. And the footage that came with him, the films were fantastic. It really exposed the regime to the world. And that's what's made them so nervous. I think if there is one reason why they are angry with Britain, is because of these images that have gone across the world and have been seen by everyone.
Masume Torfe from SOAS talking to Ian Black. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, how overfishing is threatening sharks with extinction.
There's been a huge growing market for their fins because in Asia, shark fin soup is a bit of a delicacy.
But first, in southern Afghanistan, Operation Panchai Palang, or Panther's Claw, is the biggest air assault mounted by British troops since 2001. Hundreds of soldiers were dropped from Chinooks into Babaji, one of the most dangerous insurgent strongholds. It was observed by The Guardian's John Boone, who's now in Kabul.
It certainly was a very major operation by British standards, involving a very large number of Chinook troop-carrying helicopters, some of which had to be borrowed from the Americans, because the British quite simply lack enough of these helicopters, which are very important for carrying troops, moving troops around southern Afghanistan, where many of the roads are quite perilous to travel along because of the threat from improvised explosive devices. And not only was the scale of the operation extremely impressive, so too was the operation extremely important. The British are hanging quite a lot on the success of this attempt to both clear, in military jargon, and hold an area of Helmand province, which has basically been uncontested by government forces and by foreign troops for some time now. It's essentially a Taliban stronghold, which poses threats to a number of key strategic towns in the region. The British, who've had a lot of criticism, it has to be said, that their three-year tenure running the campaign in Helmand has not had the sort of success that one might have wanted. And, you know, some people say the surge of troops that have now arrived and are arriving in Helmand, US troops, are there to essentially bail out the British. This operation, I think, will be seen as an opportunity to show the British making a real contribution on the eve of the US surge.
John Boone in Kabul. Well, staying with Afghanistan, it's been 8 years since George Bush declared the capture of Osama bin Laden, dead or alive, a national priority. But Osama bin Laden's still alive, or so it appeared on June the 3rd when an audio tape was given to Al Jazeera to coincide with Barack Obama's Middle East tour. Julian Borgia, our diplomatic editor, has been finding out what's happened to the hunt for bin Laden.
It's concentrated on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, where it has been since early 2002. There are all sorts of other theories of where he might be, but the consensus among the pundits, the intelligence agencies, the Pakistan and Afghan governments, is that he is there somewhere along that border.
We haven't seen him on video since 2007. What's his health believed to be like?
There have been all sorts of rumours about his health. He is supposed to suffer from long-term kidney disease, but rumours of his death have been much exaggerated over the months and years, and he is still out there. But I mean, the fact that we haven't seen him suggests maybe, you know, there is something to be hidden, or it may be just a security concern, the reason why he hasn't allowed himself to be filmed and all that entails, having other people involved, giving away maybe clues of his whereabouts. It's hard to know, but it's possible that he's hiding something about his appearance.
George Bush said originally that the capturing bin Laden dead or alive was a top priority. It wasn't, of course. Iraq became a distraction. How much of a distraction was it?
It drained the search for bin Laden and the attempt to wipe out al-Qaeda of its key people. There are only a certain number of people in the US intelligence agencies and special forces who have the kind of skills necessary to go out and hunt and track down a single person, an individual. Armies are trained, designed, built to fight opposing forces, not to go on manhunts. That's a very specific skill. And a lot of the people, a lot of the intelligence specialists and special forces specialists who were involved in the hunt were taken away in mid-2002, 2003 to Iraq. And that really handcuffed the manhunt going on for bin Laden and undermined it, and it didn't really get back on its feet until much later, 2006, 2007.
Well, now we've got a new president, of course. What difference has the election of Barack Obama made to the hunt for bin Laden?
Well, significant in that Obama has made his strategy one of focus on Afghanistan and a shift of emphasis away from Iraq, and a new emphasis on what the Obama team thinks ought to have been the focus all along, going after al-Qaeda, stabilizing Afghanistan. And so there is a sense that there is a renewed effort, a new push into trying to track down bin Laden and trying to finish off al-Qaeda in the tribal areas on Pakistan-Afghan border.
What difference would it make if Osama bin Laden was captured dead or alive?
That's a difficult one. Some people say it won't make any difference because the al-Qaeda network is one of cells that really are sort of self-starting. They pick their own targets. And Osama bin Laden is just a figurehead. And if he was killed, then he would be a martyr and all the more an inspirational figure. Others say what he says is important. Others point out that when he says that al-Qaeda and its affiliates should go after a certain country or a certain target, that tends to happen, that what he says tends to be carried out by his followers. One analyst described it as a concept in the U.S. Army of commander's intent. Once the commander's intent is known, people lower down the chain of command do their best to carry out that intent. Now, if he was no longer on the scene, then that intent would no longer be there. That kind of guiding force and driving inspiration would no longer be there.
Julian Borgia. Almost a third of sharks and rays found in the open ocean are threatened with extinction, largely as a result of overfishing. That's according to a major report from conservation experts. Environment's correspondent Alok Jha has the details.
So the sharks that are on this report, which is published by the World Conservation Union, include things like the scalloped hammerhead, the great hammerhead, and also something called the giant devil ray. These three species in particular are what's called endangered globally. So they're virtually wiped out and are nearing extinction. This report by the World Conservation Union is the first ever on what they're called pelagic sharks. These are sharks and rays that live in the open sea, open oceans, basically. So they're essentially global.
Why are these particular creatures at risk from overfishing?
A couple of reasons, really. Well, at first, a long time ago, they were caught in tuna fisheries and swordfish fisheries, and just they were bycatch. They were thrown back into the sea and not really cared about. But then, actually, there's been a huge growing market for their fins, because in Asia, shark fin soup is a bit of a delicacy. And, you know, until maybe 10 years ago, maybe a bit more, the shark fin soup was a delicacy, and only the richest people in China could afford it. But we all know the miracle that is China. The number of middle-class people are increasing. There's a real drive for this stuff now, and more sharks are being caught specifically for their fins. Their fins are chopped off, and their bodies are thrown back into the water. The problem is that sharks sometimes take decades to mature, and they won't have children. They won't have babies until they're 20, maybe. And then when they do have a baby, you know, they'll have one at once. And so the populations will take centuries in some cases to get back to normal.
And the open seas, the open oceans, very difficult to police, of course. But what measures could be taken to protect these creatures?
That's exactly right. They are virtually impossible to police. So shark finning is banned in some countries. So the EU has a ban on it. Japan sort of has a ban on it. But, you know, if you're in the middle of an ocean, who's going to check that? And a lot of thousands and thousands and millions of tons of fins end up in the Hong Kong fin markets every year. So clearly things are slipping through the cracks. And simply no one really bothers policing very much. So what can you do? You could probably have a much stricter policing for a start. You could have much stricter bans where you can actually not even catch a shark, never mind fin it. And the scientists in question are saying actually what you need is more people monitoring these sharks all around policed areas and making sure that the markets themselves are regulated.
Alok Jha. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.